Today we're very pleased to have as our speaker Craig Scott. Craig Scott and his wife Karen have been members of UUCB since 1998. And Craig also became a UU minister during that time, and he is a retired UU minister, having served the congregation in Sonora, California from 2005 through 2014. Before going into the ministry in a former life, he was an attorney practicing with several legal aid offices and then with the University of California. While at UUCB, he helped to reactivate social justice as the Social Justice Council and is proud to see that it continues to flourish. Craig and Karen now live in Monterey and they miss us all very much. And I might add that Karen is running for office in Monterey. So if you have any questions about that, you can talk to Craig later. Okay, we're ready to go.
So just a couple words of introduction. I want to do something a little different to open. We're going to have some opening music. All right. Well, I really appreciate you inviting me here today. It's, you know, I miss you all. And it's really good to see so many familiar faces and some new faces. I miss especially the social justice folks and the community that we had. And I wish I could be there with you in person. But this morning, I thought I'd start with something a little different. Thanks to Anne and Lonnie and their support. And that is a song that was written by Woody Guthrie in the 1930s. It's called Jesus Christ. And it feels just as relevant today as it was then in this version by the band U2.
Well, Jesus was a man who traveled through the land, a hardworking man and brave. Well, he said to the rich, give your money to the poor, but the late Jesus Christ is grave.
I wake everybody up, that song. It sort of encapsulates what I want to talk about today. What would Jesus, if Jesus were today in New York City, what would happen? It's been quite a wild ride the last few months, hasn't it? It seems as if there's some catastrophe virtually every day, and it's still 2 weeks till the election. So I assume most of you voted by now, Karen and I have, or that you're planning to do so in person or by mail soon. And if you haven't yet, please vote. This feels like the most important election we'll ever vote in, maybe. Now, of course, we can't endorse political candidates or parties, and I would never try to tell you whom to vote for. However, as congregations, we can talk about issues and policies. And we can criticize them when they go against our values. Indeed, as Unitarian Universalists, we have an obligation, I believe, to speak out about policies that are racist, sexist, anti-poor, anti-immigrant, and so on. So this morning with you, I want to look at what Jesus might have to say about some of these policies. So I want to talk about the horrific policies from the culture coming out of Washington that are being supported by folks who call themselves Christians. And yet those policies are so contrary to the actions and the teachings of the man called Jesus, whom they claim to follow. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the work of Reverend William Barber, who was one of the founders of the Moral Mondays movement and the Poor People's Campaign. This is what he had to say on the subject. This is Reverend William Barber. If you pay attention to their words, these Christian preachers who claim to represent Jesus do not quote Jesus to defend their positions. They do not claim that Jesus, who started free health clinics everywhere he went, would want to take health care away from millions of Americans. They do not say Jesus would pit Americans against immigrants. They never quote the one who said, "The last shall be first," to defend the policies of America first. For all of their appeal to people who claim to love Jesus, they tend to stay away from what Jesus actually said. And then Reverend Barber goes on to say, our nation's present moral crisis is laying bare the deep hypocrisy of many who've claimed to speak for morality and family values. How does hurting your neighbor, trampling on the immigrant, cutting housing, food, and healthcare for the poor line up with the teachings of Jesus? Well, here when I talk about Christians, I'm speaking primarily about white Christians. I'm talking about evangelical preachers such as Franklin Graham, son of Billy Graham, Robert Jeffress, and Jerry Falwell Jr. before his fall from grace. But also I'm talking about most mainstream denominations. The numbers are pretty staggering. According to Michael Luo, writing in The New Yorker, polls show that 81% of white evangelical Christians voted for Donald Trump. And large majorities of evangelicals continue to support him. Trump was supported by 64% of white Catholics and 56% of white mainline Protestants. So what are some of the positions these Christians are supporting when they support this culture coming out of Washington? Well, first of all, there's a blatant disregard of medical science about safe behaviors, which has caused the country to lead the world in cases of and deaths from COVID-19 and still climbing. Along with this denial of science, there's a culture of blatant lying and deceit, misrepresentation. There are attempts to deny millions of Americans coverage under the Affordable Care Act, including a case the administration is currently pushing before the Supreme Court. In the middle of a pandemic and with no replacement in sight, there are massive tax cuts for the wealthy while programs for the poor are being gutted. There's misogyny, sexism, and contempt for women in words and actions and policies. There's the tearing apart of families who are trying to escape violence in their home countries. And in the course of doing so, the imprisoning of children in cages without adequate food, medical care, proper hygiene, and continuing to do so in defiance of court orders. There's the adoption of openly racist policies and the denial of the existence of systemic racism, combined with the denial that all too frequent police killings of Black men and women are the denial that those killings are part of a system of oppression. There's the denial of the existence of climate change, a terrifying threat to future generations and to the very existence of what Christians refer to as God's creation, together with the dismantling of rules and regulations that protect the health and safety of all of us. There's Attorney General William Barr, whose Justice Department has carried out more federal executions than occurred during the preceding 60 years, has deterred people escaping state-sponsored torture from entering the country, and has used tear gas to dispel peaceful protesters for a photo op in front of a church. Yet, a conservative Catholic organization recently gave Barr an award as, quote, truly a Catholic public servant who embodies integrity, honesty, humility, and sincere and wise counsel, end quote. Well, I could go on and on. So how has all this happened with support from so-called Christians? What would Jesus make of these horrific policies and the approval given to them by people who claim to be his followers? Wouldn't Jesus be horrified by what's going on right now? Well, some Christians are beginning to speak out. The prominent evangelical Robert Schenck has broken with his evangelical colleagues. In a recent interview on NPR, he condemned the Faustian deal that so many of them have made to gain access in Washington. Quoting Jesus, he reminds us, what does it profit you to gain the whole world, but lose your soul? The leaders of the National Cathedral and the Catholic Archbishop in Washington have both issued statements condemning President Trump's hateful statements about people of color. I was particularly moved by the words of Father Percival da Silva, the 82-year-old pastor of the Shrine of the Blessed Sacrament, also in Washington. In a sermon, he said, "I'm compelled by Jesus Christ to say what I'm going to say. Jesus won't let me off the hook. Racism is a sin," he said, and he called on the church to work toward full inclusion of all racial and ethnic groups. He stressed the need to respect one another as children of God and spoke of racism as being rooted in fear of the unknown, of losing control, of one's own inadequacies, of those who are different. Jesus won't let me off the hook. Let's take a look at what that means. As you use, we have lots of different views about this Jesus, going all the way back to our historical roots. And we honor and we respect those differing views. But the fact of the matter is, we really don't know that much about Jesus. Who was he really? Was he an actual historical figure? Maybe. We can't be sure. Gospel narratives could be a composite of stories about various itinerant preachers of the time. They were written down a couple of generations after the time Jesus is thought to have lived. And there's only one single historical reference to Jesus apart from the Gospels. So I'm not talking about the Jesus who purportedly was the Son of God and who supposedly rose from the dead. We are Unitarians in our theology, after all. I'm not talking about the Jesus so many of us saw in a picture in Sunday school, the white Nordic-looking hippie Jesus with auburn hair and a glow behind him. Many of you, I'm sure, remember that picture. No. I'm talking about the Jesus who may have been a flesh and blood person, who roamed around and preached 2,000 years ago, the Jesus of Woody Guthrie's song. This Jesus was a preacher, a healer, a teacher, a political activist and troublemaker, and a prophet, very much within the Hebrew tradition. And like it or not, this Jesus has been seen as a source of moral authority in the world for 2,000 years. So let's look at this Jesus. Let's consider what his actions and teachings might have to say about the turmoil going on today. So what would this Jesus say about a culture of lying and deceit coming from the very top? Over and over, Jesus emphasized living by the truth. You know, for years, every time I drove by Berkeley High School, I saw Jesus' words on the wall. "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." It's from the book of John. And yes, today we do need to be set free by the truth, especially truth spoken by doctors and scientists about protecting us from this pandemic. What would Jesus have to say about the imbalance of wealth and poverty in this country? We now live in what's virtually an oligarchy. A country in which a tiny minority of very wealthy individuals and corporations have unlimited power through their access to political leaders. Armies of well-paid lobbyists flood the halls of Congress, influencing and shaping policy. And we continue to reward the wealthy with massive tax cuts while taking downright punitive measures against the poor. Repeatedly, this administration has attempted to kick people off food stamps and other public programs. And it's threatening to cut our Social Security and Medicare, which affects many of us, I know, and will affect everybody eventually. But its leader has recently been shown to have paid little or no taxes, sometimes with questionable legality. And conservative Christian leaders, some of whom are very wealthy themselves, support these policies. Jesus himself lived his life among the poor. as a successful preacher, he might have chosen to enrich himself, but instead he stood up for the poor over and over again. In his disgust at the merging of religion and greed, he famously drove the money changers out of the temple in Jerusalem. When a rich young man asked how he could follow him, Jesus said he would have to get rid of his wealth and give it to the poor. And then he told his disciples that it would be easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to get into heaven. Wouldn't Jesus want to protect people being deprived of food stamps or Social Security benefits? Wouldn't he be in favor of a $15 minimum wage or more? Wouldn't he want to reform tax policy to redistribute wealth downward rather than upward? As Woody Guthrie sang back in the 30s, he said to the rich, "Give your money to the poor." So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. And what about the place of women? We have a culture coming from the very top in which women are objectified, humiliated, in which it's fine to grab women by the genitals, at least if you think you're a celebrity, in which women are often denied access to proper medical care, including the right to make decisions about their own bodies. Mightn't followers of Jesus want to see women treated with dignity and respect? You would think so. But we do have religious leaders who ignore or defend this sexist, misogynist behavior. In Jesus' time, women were essentially treated as property. Women had to prepare the meals, but couldn't share them with the men. A woman who was not under a man's control was considered to be a loose woman, not entitled to be treated with respect. Hence the biblical description of Mary Magdalene as a prostitute, although probably she was simply a woman who lived on her own. Jesus broke with all these cultural traditions. Women, such as the sisters Mary and Martha, traveled as part of his roving band. Jesus shared meals with women. All his followers ate at the same table. We can see over and over how he listened to women and treated them with respect. How would he react to the misogyny and sexism emanating from Washington? I can easily see him preaching in American congregations for respectful, equal treatment for women. Also, by the way, we don't know of any gay members of Jesus' entourage, but we do know that there's nothing in any of Jesus' teachings that condemns homosexuality. Now, some people argue it's a different story for Paul and for some Hebrew Bible passages, although I disagree, but that's a conversation we can have another day. So many Christians today are willing to remain quiet about ripping apart families and confining children in cages in dangerous and unsanitary conditions at our southern border, and even to support the policies that put them there. Children as young as 2 months, unwashed for weeks, without a change of clothes, sleeping on cold concrete floors, torn from the arms of their parents. These children will be seriously traumatized for life. And there's the broader issue of imprisoning or simply turning away people of all ages escaping from serious danger in their home countries, characterizing them as criminals and rapists, taking away their humanity by demonizing them. Last March, Vice President Pence, who loudly proclaims his Christian piety, effectively ordered the border sealed, southern border sealed, over the objections of the scientists at the Centers for Disease Control, who said there's no evidence that doing so would protect against coronavirus. So how would Jesus look at these anti-immigrant practices? In the gospel attributed to Matthew, Jesus says, "I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me." In his famous Sermon on the Mount, Jesus speaks of those who are poor in spirit, meek, persecuted, saying that they will get their reward in heaven. As a teacher in the Hebrew tradition, Jesus was certainly aware of the passages in Exodus and Leviticus saying, "You shall not oppress the alien, and the alien who resides among you shall be as a citizen among you, for you were once aliens in the land of Egypt." Also remember the parable of the Good Samaritan, in which the hero of the story is from a people who were reviled and considered to be other. Let's remember that the Jesus of the Gospels, whose picture we saw, would himself have had a brown skin and a Semitic look, not like that white hippie. If that Jesus were to get on an airplane today, some people would probably refuse to sit next to him, and he would no doubt be hassled when he tried to enter the country. With respect to children, Jesus rebukes the disciples who want to keep children from coming up to him. Jesus welcomes them and says that the kingdom of heaven belongs to them. Here, Jesus is presumably remarking about the innocence of children and telling his disciples that they need to be like children to follow him. Then Jesus admonishes the disciples to actively protect children. He says that if anyone causes a child to stumble, it would be better for that person to have a millstone around his neck and be drowned in the sea. Now, that may sound a little harsh, but I think we can get to Jesus' point that we're supposed to take care of children. Is it possible to imagine the Jesus of the Gospels turning away people fleeing danger and poverty? Can we imagine him being countenancing holding children in cages in safe, unsanitary conditions? Of course not. Jesus would see the humanity, the human potential in each of these asylum seekers. And yet so many on the Christian right defend our government's practices and criticize churches, such as our UU denomination, that try to help asylum seekers at the border. And yes, we have, and I'm proud to say that as a movement, the Unitarian Universalist Association, we have been active at the border working with folks. And we've come under criticism from evangelical churches for doing so. So let's turn to healthcare. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, enabled millions of uninsured Americans to have access to decent healthcare, as we all know. From its inception, this administration has tried to repeal the ACA without having any replacement plan in mind. They would callously deprive millions of the healthcare they need. Many of our states refused the Medicaid expansion that would have enabled poor people to have access to healthcare. And currently, the administration is before the Supreme Court, asking it to declare the ACA unconstitutional. Adding another justice to the court may very well put a final nail in the ACA without any plan to replace it. The indifference to suffering is staggering. Healthcare must be seen as a human right, as it is in so many countries around the world. The Jesus of the Gospels was a healer. People came to him to be cured of various maladies, blindness, leprosy, a woman with uncontrolled menstrual flow. As they're recounted when they're written down generations later, these healings are miraculous. But it may well be that Jesus had the knowledge and the gift to be a healer of some sort. There have been people throughout history who had the gift of healing. And as Reverend Barber said, Jesus started health clinics wherever he traveled. He cared about the people he met along the way. And he never charged anyone with a copay. The Jesus of the Gospels would never countenance denying people, any people, access to decent health care. Well, we could go on, but I think the point is clear. Much is made of the myth that this is a white Christian nation. But so many policies of this administration are so unchristian, and they find support among so many people who claim to be Christian. Jesus brought a message of love, not hate. And yet hatred is being spewed constantly. Hatred of the other. Hatred of anyone whose skin is not white. Hatred of people from other countries. These messages coming from Fox News and the White House and Christian preachers are meant to make us afraid and to divide us from our neighbors. If the Jesus of the Gospels were alive with us today, he would speak out against the bigotry, the hate, the meanness, the brutality. They killed Jesus for speaking truth to power, just as they killed Dr. King and Malcolm X and Gandhi and so many others. So to go back to Woody Guthrie's song, today, if Jesus were to preach what he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus' message was radical, yes. He preached about an all-encompassing love, a love that included immigrants, women, children, people needing health care, the poor, and so on. His message is just as radical today as it was in his time. It's a message that has inspired people for thousands of years, a message we need to believe in this dark time. We need to continue to believe that light can drive out darkness and that love can drive out hate. Jesus won't let us off the hook. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. I really appreciate those remarks. I'd be curious to know, have you put any thought or what your personal opinion is as to how Christianity has been hijacked, if that's my phrase, to the point where we are now, that message of the original message of Jesus from the Gospels has been lost? Do you have any speculations or thoughts?
Well, I can tell you my view. I think that there's always a difference between a religion's theology and a religion's institutional being. And I think what tends to happen is, and this goes way back, I mean, this goes back to the time of the Emperor Constantine, religions begin to solidify, to ossify, to have, you know, not just priests, but deacons and bishops and archbishops and on and on and on, and they become institution builders. And I think that's a lot of what happens here. And then those institutions want access to power. So they're not really governed by their theology particularly, they're governed by their need to survive and flourish as an institution. I don't know, maybe other people have ideas about that. That's how I see it. That began a long time ago.
Yeah. In the chat section, we do have a question. It says, can we get a list of the Bible passages you're quoting?
Oh.
Yeah, would you be able to do that at some point?
Well, there were just two Bible passages. One is from Mark, where he says, what does it profit you to gain the whole world but lose your soul? Well, that's Mark 8:36. And you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free is John 8:32.
Okay.
Let me repeat those.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? If you want to put your question in the chat room or if you want to raise your hand, Lonnie will keep an eye out, as I will also. You can also raise your hand via the Zoom website, or comments would be most welcome.
I see Helen Toy's hand up.
Yay, Helen.
Helen. Got to unmute yourself.
It's great to see you and hear you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Only by Zoom. What I'm wondering is, apart from the institutions, why do you think individual Christians in this country now are thinking in such inhumane ways? Because I think they're probably very nice to their neighbors. I've lived in small Christian town. People are very nice to each other, very kind and helpful and thoughtful, but they seem to push out the rest of the world and in terms of policies. What do you think is going on? Why is that happening here and now?
It's a good question. I think that, and I don't know, I don't have answers to it, but it seems to me that there's somehow in humans, there's this need for me and them, I and other. Along this line, I know that LFDC group is going to take this up in February, but the book Cast by Isabel Wilkerson is a wonderful exposition of how this works in America, how people have this need to keep their place within a caste system, which means to be better than somebody, right? It's not so, and her argument is it's not so much, I mean, race is a factor in the caste system, but it's really caste that is going on, that people's need to be better than somebody else, the other. That's one way of looking at it. We could talk about that a long time.
All right, we have Paul, then we have Dorothy, and Ray has, if you can put your hand up in the participants list at the bottom where it says participants, there's also a raised hand there, and it's a little easier for us to see as we have more people, that we might not see on the screen. But Paul, and then Dorothy, for what I see right now. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, could you hear me okay?
Yes.
Having grown up in a early right-wing evangelical family and departing from that style about my teen years gradually and now completely, I hope to say, but not quite. My couple siblings, it was four of us, and two of my siblings abhorred Donald Trump during the primaries, but then admitted sheepishly later they voted for him. I do want to have a conversation with them about that, but it's a very difficult one to have, of course, these days. But I am reminded of an article that I looked up. I'm a psychologist, and I looked up, I believe it was in one of the more prestigious American Psychological Association journals that did describe a large research project, and the results were that there were very distinct differences between those that would be characterized as right-wing evangelicals and those who were not. And I can't remember all of those. I'll see if I can dig up that article, and I'm happy to forward it on. I couldn't find it for the meeting. But my sense is that there are real genetic differences, having seen in my own family quite a broad spectrum of behavior that is clearly genetic, including, an autistic son. And then environmental upbringing, and yes, the us versus them, self-validation, how do you validate yourself and who you are? And that has to do with self-efficacy. Everybody wants to be effective in their own life. I think it's all wrapped together, and I'd be happy to try to dig through this. I haven't looked at this. The latest article that I did photocopy anyway was about 2001.
Thank you.
Anyway, I think there's a whole lot of research out there on fairly objective, good evidence-based research on the differences between evangelicals that can help explain a lot of this.
Thank you. Who is next, Lon?
Dorothy, you were next. Go ahead, dear. Am I
unmuted? Okay.
Yes, you are.
I'm reading Michael Cohen's book, and all the way through, he worked for Trump for 10 years. All the way through when he was doing the bullying and lying and enabling, he asked himself, why am I doing this? Why? And over again, he comes back that he wanted to please the boss. He works with three or four other colleagues, George Sorrell and some others who were, they talked to each other. They knew that he was irresponsible and avoiding any responsibility for his mistakes, which he made all the time. And he was lying, but they couldn't stop themselves. They couldn't stop themselves. He said it was such a rush when Trump would say, thank you, that was a good job. They get such a rush, they keep right on doing it. So what, he doesn't know what kept him doing this for 10 years. Just incredible. It's a very interesting, and he showed a picture of the evangelicals laying their hands on Trump, making him part of them. And he knows it's a complete farce. The man doesn't believe in anything but himself, but he kept doing it. He kept doing it over and over and over, a compulsion, an obsession, and you guys.
Ah, Dorothy, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dorothy. Hey, Ray, you're next, dear. Ray.
All right. Yeah, hi, Craig. Welcome back. It's good to see you. And
Hi, Ray.
Thank you for your wise and wonderful words. I have a question about the Bible. I mean, I was taught as a child that the Bible is the inspired word of God, and I don't believe that anymore. And there are many very positive things in the Bible, you know, yeah. Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' words, but there's also a lot of very not so good things, support of slavery, misogyny, homophobia, and just what's your general view of the Bible, and particular those not so nice things in the Bible?
Well, the Bible is, you know, 2,000 years old, after all. Way older than that, actually, the Hebrew Bible, way older than that. But we have to remember that things were basically passed on by oral traditions in the time that we're talking about, in the time of Jesus. Things, you know, they didn't have cell phones, and they didn't have email, and they didn't even have print. So things were passed on by oral traditions, and the Gospels, for example, were written at least two full generations after the time of Jesus. So word was passed along in that time. So we have to look at the context in which stuff was written down a lot. I look at the Bible as not divine inspiration, but as a source worth looking to for beauty, for wisdom. I think Song of Songs, so many of the Psalms, the Book of Job, which is my particular personal favorite. There's a lot that's beautiful, and I think we're intelligent beings. We need to decide what we take and what we reject, and there's plenty to reject. I agree.
Right, that's a great question. It really ties into the questions that I've had with my evangelical friends who freak out when I remind them that Jesus was Jewish. All right, Bob Adams, can you give us your question? Your hand is up next.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to point out that somebody asked for a list of the excerpts that Craig cited, but the entire Gospels, for the four Gospels, are only 121 pages. So I would suggest out of the whole Bible that they are pretty easy to read, and then you can consider the rest of it as you want to, but there's not, you know, it's... That's it out of the whole Bible. So excerpts. There's a lot there, more than Craig had time to point out.
Well, those are what's known as the Synoptic Gospels. There's also, of course, the Gospel of Thomas, which was discovered much, much later.
Yeah. The other thing, I'll just leave it there. I had another thought, but I'll let it go.
Thanks, Bob.
Good to see you, Bob.
Yeah.
And Catherine, you had your hand up. Can you unmute and give us your
question? I'm sorry to put this in. I didn't think I would have time to ask these questions. So I put, first of all, Bob, about the Gospels, that's what the Jefferson Bible is. And that's the only Bible I ever read from. So if you want to focus just on those, that's a good place to get it. This is a more of a neurological question. Do you think the us versus them mindset, this tribal point of view, is a survival strategy inherent to the brainstem versus the frontal lobe? The brainstem being what we really can't control, and the frontal lobe that gives us the ability to react differently.
Are you asking me that, Catherine?
I'm asking anybody that.
Because I don't feel qualified to talk to answer that question, except that to say that it does seem as if humans have this sort of, I don't know if we're hardwired or what, but that we, to be tribal.
Okay. And I asked that because I was reading Buddha's Brain, which is a really fascinating book. And then my other question was, is there a reason, or does anybody notice that these Christians quote from the Old Testament, particularly Leviticus, instead of the New Testament, which is Jesus? Do they not understand that? I mean, my understanding is that Christianity basically starts in the New Testament.
The Old Testament, I think the Old Testament is very much the Hebrew Bible.
Yes.
It is part of the Christian canon. I mean, it definitely is. You buy a Christian Bible, it's going to have the Old Testament. I think that, and so much of, and Jesus was a prophet in the Hebrew tradition. So I think it's fairly consistent to do that. As with the New Testament or the Old Testament, you have to be really careful about people who pick out, you know, a passage, call it proof texting, and use that to prove their position. And I think one that we all talk about, I'm sure you've had this conversation at the church, is passages about homosexuality. You can find a passage in the Bible to prove almost anything you want to prove if you look hard enough. And I could go on, I have at times, about why their views, what they take out of the Old Testament about gays is just flat wrong. But that's a kind of a long conversation.
We're pointing out that so many of these people that will talk about homosexuality being against, being abhorrent, don't realize that Leviticus also says that tattoos are abhorrent. I mean, it's just picking and choosing. So I guess that's what I mean.
Catherine, thank you. Because I that is one of the big arguments that I get into, which is, if Jesus came in the New Testament and he said, I'm kind of giving you the new news, why are they dealing with the Old Testament? So I have the same question. Dave Lingenfelter, you're up next in terms of your question.
Well, thank you, Lonnie. And thank you, Craig. I really appreciate hearing your words this morning and seeing you again. It's not so much a question, it's actually a little criticism, not of Craig in particular, but of Unitarians, I think, in general, and observation. And that is, we tend to be too focused on the good and not willing to look at the evil. I was thinking about the words in Matthew chapter 10, verse 16, where he says, behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. I think the problem is that we're not as wise as serpents. And we have failed to see the monstrous evil that has crept over the land to corrupt everything. It goes, but its primary name is transnational organized crime. And I won't go into it because there's not enough time. It's huge. But it's, I think, the big problem with Unitarians and in the religious community in general is we've failed to see the monstrous evil in our midst.
David, that is so profound. Going along with the brainstem that you were talking about, what Catherine was talking about, and maybe we'll get you to do a big talk on that that subject. Roberta, you're up next in terms of your question, dear.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Roberta.
Thanks. Yes, well, the original question, you know, a few questions back was, why is it that all these Christians are in favor of Trump? It seems to me that a big issue is the pro-life, pro-choice, the abortion thing, because I was shocked. You said 64% of Catholics are on Trump's side. And I would think that that's the big thing for them and also for a lot of evangelicals. And it strikes me, I hope some of you might know the statistics now, but a few years back anyway, there was a poll taken that it was something like 70% of Americans were pro-choice. I mean, did not have any issue about abortion, you know, was okay. So 70, you know, I don't know. I hope it's still that way because, because those statistics of how many evangelicals and Catholics were pro-Trump are pretty scary. So I don't know if anybody else has I'd feel better if I knew that there is a high percentage of people who are pro-choice.
I think it's something like 75%.
Pardon, 70?
75.
Uh-huh.
I think it was seen recently.
Yeah, well, okay, thank you.
Yes, and Roberta, again, the hypocrisy of, you know, killing people in the streets, but and death penalty and all of that, this is not my time to go ranting. All right, thank you so much, Roberta. Natalie, you're up next.
Okay, thanks. So, Craig, other than kind of the hope in salvation and reliance on God the Father, which, you know, doesn't work for many of us you use, do you find any, or what do you find in terms of hope and kind of relief from despair? Is there anything in Jesus's teaching other than, you know, the hope for salvation and reliance in God the Father that we as you use can take hope in? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think I tried to go there towards the end of the talk, but I think Jesus' message was a message of love. It was a message of love, and he spoke it in many different ways. The story of the Good Samaritan, the Sermon on the Mount, and so on. I think, and those were dark times too. You know, the Romans were rampaging around Palestine, and those weren't easy times either. I think that Jesus is telling us all to be to be good troublemakers. I think Jesus was a good troublemaker, and I think that he very much, his message is telling us to do that. I don't know what else to say off the top of my head. that's a kind of a weighty question, but that's the best I can do at the moment.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Natalie, you know, I think the practical Jesus, where he talks about, you know, the true on the Sabbath, we're not supposed to do anything, but if your sheep is lost, would you not go look for them? You know, so I always found some of the practical, let's not just buy into the law type of message coming from Jesus. And guys, check your chatter. Anne will mention it about something that Paul sent. I'm going to bring up the next question. Bob, do you mind waiting for a second till Wendy has her question so she can go? Thank you, dear. Hey, Wendy, you're up, sweetie.
Okay, so I
need
just
to be added... loud. Hey, Wendy, can you get closer to your microphone?
All right, so I'm hollering right into it.
Okay.
Even though it makes it harder to read my lips. So I put in the chat a link to Born to Be Good by Dacher Keltner, which answers a lot of those questions about the limbic brain and the prefrontal lobe. And that talks about how humans, because of our large brain and our frontal lobe, take a whole lot of care, particularly the first 6 months of life. And that this has caused evolution to give us all of these communicative and collaborative skills. And it's necessary to work in community. Now, some of this tribal stuff comes from the need to take care of the small hunter-gatherer groups, but the main thrust of what Dacher Keltner, who is in the Greater Good Science Center here in Berkeley, has to say is that the majority of our evolution as human beings really leans towards cooperation and communication, and that our physical, emotional being points us in that direction. I just wanted to point that out, and thank you so much for your talk. I went back to school in religious studies after a healing crisis and read both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And wow, that New Testament is really something else when you just look at this man's life and the kind of behavior he exemplified of compassion towards other human beings.
I love that, Wendy. Thank you for that book reference. That was great. And like you said, during a time that Reverend Craig said, during a dark time, well, we know he was slaughtered for speaking truth to power, as many of, and I don't particularly want to be slaughtered, you know. I mean, that's fear is a real thing. But to have the courage to do good trouble, you know, that's something that I think we're all still working on as Unitarians. Bob, can we have some of your wisdom too this morning? Some more?
We'll see. But the other comment I wanted to make, which went back to what Craig was talking about of the beginning of institutional Christianity in 325 AD, the Council of Nicaea, that council outlawed a whole bunch of other things that were from Orthodox to heresies, and Unitarianism was one of them way back then, which was a thread of early Christianity that was prominent in that part of the world, among other things. And the observation that I have coming from that was that, having lived in some other cultures, that every long historical culture has had its version of institutionalized religion that decides that other ones are not so good, whether it's Hinduism with the caste system, or in versions of that in China and Japan, wherever you want to look, the Nile Valley. These cultures had slavery as endemic to their origins in a lot of ways, and some extent still do. So what's people treating Christianity as this, I find this among Unitarians, treating Christianity as kind of a whole thing that we're can't figure out and all of that. To me, institutional Christianity is just, that's what's been done everywhere in every time. And the other is that I see Unitarianism as not, this is what I was going to take up with what David said, as not being too hopeful in the sense of being naive about evil, that I see Unitarianism as a resistance movement against this institutional Christianity. And it's always been, historically, it's been that. And if you look at Christians for the first 300 years, they were massively sacrificed by the Romans, you know, the Colosseum and all that stuff. Christians were one of their favorite entertainments of slaughtering Christians. So, you know, that, so Jesus' message was taken up by people all over the eastern part of the Roman Empire, and to their to their great sacrifice. So we tend, and those were hundreds of years after all the people in the Bible were long, in the New Testament world, had been dead for a very long time. And so Christianity is not unique in that respect. And it's typical in that, the institutional Christianity, typical in that respect. So I'm not upset about the nature of what has happened with institutional Christianity as being confounding. I feel it is more like just gives us focus on what we're about.
Wow, that was really insightful, Bob, to talk about Unitarian Universalism as a resistance religion. I really want to pursue that with you. That's very interesting to think of it that way. I'm always trying to get together some way to encapsulate it when I'm asked about what, you know, Unitarian Universalism is about. And that was very, very helpful to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind? Just one other thing, that in Transylvania, the European refuge for Unitarians who fled Italy when the Catholic Church went after them, that was the furthest extent of the Islamic Empire, and they were interacting with them in a friendly way. And that was one of the things that caused a lot of rub between them and the more institutionalized Christian Europe, was that they were not anti-Muslim.
Interesting. Okay. We have Anne Greenwood, and then we'll have Paul again. Anne Greenwood, and we have Barbara after the Anne.
Thing, Bob, that you just brought up, Transylvania, because that was what I was going to.
Anne, can you get closer to your mic, sweetie?
Our cousins, the basis of the Hungarian and Unitarian church in Transylvania is we follow Jesus, we don't worship him, and they often use a biblical passage to start out their worship services, their sermons. And yet they still have, homophobia is rampant there culturally. So I don't think that we escape our cultural milieu. Also, I like to remember Reverend Catt, who called Unitarians heretics, and just made the case that that's who we are in our religion.
Barbara, your question is next.
I wanted to ask Craig if, having come from a legal background and then coming into the church, it was because of seeing all the injustices, and tying that to Jesus' teaching, that influenced you to go into the ministry.
Well, it wasn't particularly Jesus that drew me, I must say, but my legal practice was actually a social justice practice for the most part. So I think ministry is kind of a continuation of wanting to do in some small way a little bit of good in the world. And legal training is always useful. Mm-hmm. Minister or, you know, whatever you do, it's always useful.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Absolutely. Paul, do you want to talk to us?
You know, just on the topic of abortion, it's certainly a hot button issue that just simply may transcend everything else, you know, save the babies. It's good, you know, it's a pretty strong emotional appeal. And I did read an article, and in this day of possible disinformation, I hesitate to verify its authority without remembering what its source was. But I can find that and send it. But it did discuss something that happened at Bob Jones University, and that was strategizing for politics at the time of desegregation and McCarthyism. And that was the article says they were not successful in promoting a whites first agenda, which Bob Jones was very strict about that, very racist in those days. I don't know now, but the strategy change was to use abortion as a hot button topic. And up until that time, I believe most Christian churches did not have such an anti-choice view. In fact, I believe the article cites that there was considerable doctrine at the time that the soul was created at birth, not at conception. And I think that's an arguing point that if you want to talk to evangelicals, you would get into. The second thing is religion and politics. Yeah, religion does have some power over people. Theology does. Once you have power, it becomes political, and then it simply may stay political and no longer be about theology.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. I know we're already acknowledging Karen that has joined Craig, and it's so good to see you.
Hi.
See all of you.
Yeah, hi.
Hey. Thank you for the work that you're doing, Karen, with the water and running for office, and that's quite a challenge. So
it sure is. It is very much so, but thank you for the work you're doing. This is also great, and it's good to see all of you.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Natalie's
missed you.
Yep, Natalie's waving also from behind her screen.
Yeah, I got it.
Right. I dragged her out of another meeting to wave hello. So
I'm in an indivisible meeting. So yes. I will return to that. Great to see all of you, and stay well.
Yeah, you too. Stay well.
Great to see you, Karen.
Thank you.
So Anita, do you want to mention what you had talked to me about, you know, we're out in Marina Bay, how you were surprised about suddenly this fear jumping in to the residents?
Yeah, sorry, I just saw your chat remark. Sorry about that, Lonnie, I wasn't following the chat. So yeah, I'm on the Marina Bay Neighborhood Council, and there are certain citizens who live here who are just constantly worried. They want to hear the police reports every month, and we haven't been having physical meetings for some time now. We did a candidate forum a month ago for a district council, but I'm always surprised that there's this high interest in, we've got to have the stats, because as our beat cop says, crime is almost non-existent in the Marina. And yet there's this fear here that people think things are happening and they want to hear about it. And he's saying, you know, if you look at the city of Richmond, there's a lot of crime, but if you look at the Marina, there's maybe a speeding ticket that's in our crime reports. And it's funny, the level of paranoia that can sometimes exist. And also that we have sorry for the reference of the name Karen, but we have quite a few so-called Karens making calls to the police over inconsequential things going on. And I've been trying to talk to neighbors one-on-one, like, why did you call the police on a man who's clearly having problems with life, who's yelling at the sky? Is that person really going to create harm for you? But calling the police may indeed create harm for him. So I don't know where all this comes from, but there's fears out there, I think, that are unwarranted.
And so I was talking to Anita about something that maybe our Unitarians, we have something on our website that we put something, you know, things to stay conscious about, you know, Wendy was saying about the frontal lobe and a lot of, you know, our neuroscientists here about just keeping in front. Oh yeah, that's right. I'm kind of falling into the fear-based messaging that is going out there, and not the messages of love that certainly Unitarians talk about. But maybe we do need to give language. So that, thank you, Anita. When she told me that, I was like, what? They have speeding tickets and they're worried about, you know, the Oakland people are gonna come up and what, you know? So it's that irrational fear. And I think the whole abortion issue is a red herring in the fundamentalist community. I think it's the word that we use for all the other things that they don't want to support for humanity. Let me see, do we have any more questions that are coming up for Reverend Craig?
Yeah, it's 10:46, so we do need to...
All right, Cordell, we're going to... Well, we have about 4 minutes here, if you want to unmute and...
I decided to actually write an article versus throw a big question out there at this moment. But to the neuroscience concerns, if we understand the human being and how they're organized, a fundamental idea is that we are complex and we have multiple states that we can live in. And one state is based upon danger and responding to danger. And another state is safety, how we behave when we're safe. And the way our society plays us, if I can use that language, is they use messaging, the stories we tell, the news we broadcast, the language we use, to manage our state. And so there's value to someone to keep us in a state of fear. When we're frightened, we're less intelligent. And when we're frightened, we look to the strong man as the answer. When we're safe, we're more willing to be expose ourselves and be open to the other. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we manage the emotions of people, to that extent, we control their behaviors and manage our agenda. So this is not accidental. We are being used by people who understand how human beings function. Mm-hmm. We have to be as strategic as well to restore our balance. We have to either have a movement around narrative and messaging so that we can give people messages that say life is good. And in fact, our solution right now at this time is not to fight. Unball your fists. Use your lips and hug and kiss somebody. I mean, it's just a different way of looking at the world, but we do not control. So if you look at television, you see the movies and the shows are all about crime and about horror and such. The whole purpose of that is to keep us manageable. So it doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from, a society controlled by individuals who know how to use this human machinery. And it's our job as a church to know how to balance ourselves and then to promote the knowledge or the technology of that balancing outward. So I'm just, and I'll write an article about that because I think it's not something that can be understood and absorbed in 4 minutes, but essential that we understand.
That's great. You got thumbs up from Gil Weissman. He's got major thumbs up and head nodding. And David, David does remind us that in addition, you know, those masters of that manipulation also have to be dealt with. That we,
reptilian brain is yours. Get it back.
Yeah, you know, repossess
your reptilian brain and use it for, you know, not for somebody else. When you need to run, not when you need to run or fight for somebody else. We'll get there. We'll talk. I'm gonna be comprehensive and kind of careful about it because it's important that it be well understood.
Thank All right, Miss Ann, we are near our church worship time. So
we are. Thank you so much, Craig. Yeah. This is great. You stimulated a really excellent conversation for our group.
By the way, everything Jesus said was about calming the reptilian brain, if you want to put it in neuroscientific terms.
Right.
Yeah. And moving us into a parasympathetic nervous system state, and then you love.
I like that. That'll be the next talk, the parasympathetic nervous system and Jesus.
Okay.
Go, Cordell. Okay.
Thank you. Get out there and vote.
Ann, let's give Craig the last word. Craig,
let me just say how glad I am to see all of you, how much I appreciate being asked to come up. I look forward to the time when I can come up again and actually be with you in person. But meanwhile, vote, stay safe, be well. I love you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.